Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fuckadelics? What the fuckaholics? I am Mark Maron. This is WTF. Welcome to the show. Thank you. Yes. I'm a little sick. I know you can hear it in your head. I apologize that you can hear my sick head in your head. But that's just the way it is. I don't know what it is. It's hard to tell what it is anymore. Things have changed since I was a kid. It's indecipherable what kind of virus you have. Is it a cold? Is it a flu? Is it bronchitis? Is it some weird combination? Did the flu and the cold fuck each other? And now we get this weird thing, this hybrid flu-cold thing. That's what I think it is. Because I'm not immobilized like a flu, but I feel flu-y. Had a little fever. My head's all stuffed up. My chest feels like someone was sitting on it all night. I got a little of this. Can you hear that down there? Not that productive, but it's in there. Something deep. Got a demon in my lungs. But I feel okay. I feel better than I did. Nothing worse than getting sick on a shoot, man. Hey, before I start whining about my sickness, Marination, my spring tour, starts April 9th in Washington, D.C. at the Warner Theater. And then continues to Philadelphia, Boston, Madison, Wisconsin, Pittsburgh, Royal Oak, Michigan, Toronto, Houston, Dallas, Seattle, Vancouver, San Francisco, Asheville, North Carolina, Charleston, South Carolina, Atlanta, and New Orleans. Go to WTFpod.com and click on the calendar to get all the dates, venues, and links to buy tickets. I'm touring. I'm going out there. And that'll be ongoing. We'll see how it goes, folks. We'll see how it goes. I got the new hour. I got the new stuff. I got things I got to say. I want to entertain. I'm here. I'm an entertainer. Did a little reach out for some tour art, see what comes in. I figure I can do poster art for every city, really, by different artists. And then cut a deal with them. Maybe make the posters available at the venue for the show that the poster represents. That's my big plan. That's my big merch plan. I'm a businessman. Today's Jim Gaffigan Day. Jim Gaffigan has been on WTF in a few different versions. He was on a very early episode that we did in New York before I left New York with the show, before it was really an interview show. It was him and his wife was in the room, and she was talking as well. She writes for him. It was the two of them. And then I did another one backstage somewhere where I interviewed, I think it was 80 Miles. And then he did a small one. I feel like he's been on the show a few times in one version or another. But this is the only full WTF interview. So that's exciting. I don't know what I have, but it was really unnerving to do these, you know, to be shooting a show, because you want to have a good time. You want to be in it. You want to be acting. You want to be, you know, available with full focus and energy. And then, like, I'm being dragged down by this goddamn monster inside of me, this virus. And I know maybe I'm a baby. I guess I am, but I was sick, man. And as people who have to go to work know, like, there was no not going to work. You know, we're shooting a show with my name on it. I can't call in and be like, nah, I don't know, today's not good, I don't feel good. All right, let's just close down shop, take the hit for $100K, and hopefully you'll feel good tomorrow, whatever it would cost, I don't know. So on Thursday, I guess it was, they had a doctor come in when I started to feel like I was getting sick. We had a set doctor come in. And I said, I don't know what to tell you, man. I just thought I should see somebody. I don't know what to do. Maybe I need antibiotics. I'm not an antibiotic guy, but maybe give me some antibiotics. She said, oh, I'll give them to you. I don't know if they'll do anything. She goes, you know, I have the B12 shots. I'm like, yeah? She goes, yeah, a lot of people love them. They swear by them. Like, I never had a B12 shot. I don't know what it means. Isn't that the thing that, you know, like Belushi used to do after, you know, a 5-day Coke bender and schwitzing down at the 9th Street Baths? Do a B12 shot? Isn't that the remedy for hard living? She, yeah, I don't know. I got one if you want one. So I did it. I got a B12 shot. And I think for about an hour, I felt very, very lively. I don't know. It was hard to tell. Maybe it helped, maybe it didn't. But I will tell you this. I got to work with Lucy Davis, who was playing my manager in a couple episodes this year. You might know her. She was on the original Office with Ricky Gervais, and it was a real honor and a blast to do comedic scenes with her. Another kind of weird highlight for me, and this is kind of a bizarre one, is that, you know, we do casting and people come into Reefa parts. And there was a part on another episode for a doctor. And I looked at the castings. I looked at the actress who read, you know, I see them all from the casting agent. And Gregory White was one of the guys who read for the doctor part. Now, Gregory White was that guy on that McDonald's commercial, that old guy that a lot of people thought looked like me. I used to get busted all the time. My balls busted constantly because that guy looked like an old version of me. It was a McNuggets commercial, I think. Either you know it or you don't. But this is the guy that was in that commercial who looks like me, and I do and will cop to the fact that he looks like me. And I couldn't help myself. I'm like, God, I got to hire that guy. We got to have that guy. And it was hilarious. He was hilarious. We did a great scene, and it was very exciting for me in this weird way. But so shooting, like, I'm glad I feel a little better. I'm a little less congested. I just, you know, it's weird when you get sick, you get angry. And like, God, like, you know, I know people deal with chronic illness, and like, it's just, it's horrifying. You know, you just feel immobilized. And I was just hoping I'd feel a little better by today. And I do. I just want my voice back so we don't have inconsistencies. Do you know what I mean? Because, you know, you shoot out of sequence. So like, hey, what, like, how come in that last scene, Mark didn't sound not sinusy? Did he just get a horrible cold driving to the store? So, hey, hopefully nobody will notice, if you know what I'm saying. Did another funny scene with Amanda Booth, an actress and model person. She was great. Funny scene. Oh, my God, being sick, all I want to do is eat peanut butter on toast. Peanut butter and honey on toast. I don't know where that comes from, but like, I just gave myself license. I must have eaten a fucking full jar of peanut butter and a half a loaf of bread on toast because that's all I wanted to eat when I was sick. Is that good? Is it starve a cold, punch a fever in the face? Starve a cold, feed a fever? I don't know, man. I woke up with a fever and I plowed through. Ate a bunch of peanut butter and toast. Had some juice, took a bunch of vitamins, took some antibiotics, doing all I can. Had some fever dreams. Those are really the best. Those are really the best. As a sober person, you know, and I don't get to enjoy mild hallucinogenic fun. So when the fever dreams came, one of them was pretty compelling. The other one was bizarre. One, I was on an island or something, and I had to be somewhere else, but I had taken a boat to the island, and I had parked the boat, and I was going to fly off the island, but I knew that I'd taken the boat there, and I didn't really know what to do about the boat, and I didn't know how I was going to get back. I don't know if I could leave the boat where it was supposed to be left, but I was really in a conundrum. It was a really difficult situation. Like, I think I might have to take this boat all the way back to the mainland because I did rent it and bring it out here. I can't just leave the boat here with nobody knowing whose boat it is. That was the big problem. I don't know how that resolved itself. Not a very compelling fever dream. Not as compelling as the dream I had that my brain was reprogramming itself. I had this weird dream that my brain was kind of either rebooting or reprogramming itself. And it was beginning with every with images of every architectural structure I'd ever been in. So it was just like this flash of structures and buildings, just like picture after picture of buildings after buildings. It was like a mutoscope. You remember those? I don't know if you had when they were a Nickelodeon arcade thing. Benny Levine used to have one in his shoe store in Pompton Lakes when I was a little kid, where you roll this, you kind of crank this thing on the side and it kind of flips pictures over. So it looks like moving like a, it's a predecessor to the film projector. But it was like that. Only all the pictures were different and didn't work in a sequence, and they were just folding into my brain matter. Fuck, man. I wonder if that really happened. I wonder if that during that fever, my brain kind of, my hyperthalamus just did a reboot because of the heat. Don't know. I don't know. I'm tired of worrying about it. Hey, you know what? Let's talk to Jim Gavin.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Again. So you have kids, so you have to have time, you make time to do things that you might have missed or gotten away from.
Absolutely. Like the superhero thing. I never.
So are you just getting into superheroes?
I never got into. I don't believe in heroes.
Yeah. Well,
it's a very profound statement there. There are no such things as heroes. No, but my kids, you know, Spider-Man. We have five or six Spider-Man outfits.
Yeah.
And then we have some for the kids.
But, well, I get it. But I mean, but it's not, but are you finding you're like enjoying the stories? Like you're like, how did I miss this? And
yeah, I think somehow, how did I miss this?
Well, what were you doing, Jim?
I was the youngest of six, so I think
Well, there must have been a lot of shit around left over to go through.
No, I think there wasn't. I think there was, I mean, you know, Star Wars. I saw Star Wars in the movie theater. I was like, eh, sorry.
Yeah, but
and my kids, you know, we own it, so yeah. They watch it.
Regularly?
Once a week. I've been Darth Vader for 3 years for Halloween.
Really?
I was Darth Vader at my son's. He's eight now at his fourth birthday party, and I did a lightsaber thing with him, and I won.
Good. Well, you got to get it where you can, Jim.
You know.
Yeah. But so your brothers, what was the breakdown of the siblings?
The siblings?
Yours.
Four boys and two girls, and I'm the youngest of six.
There wasn't like a stack of records and a bunch of comic books?
There were records, but there was not comic books,
they
not
weren't
a thing.
Really. Wasn't there? They didn't like it. What was what? How? What's it? How old's your oldest brother?
The oldest in my family is my sister Kathy, and she's I don't know. She could be like 100, and I wouldn't know. And then my brother Mike is I don't know 50s.
Yeah, somewhere in
it's
there.
It's all a blur. You know, it's like who cares?
Well, you kind of know.
I mean, I kind of know that, you know, there's six kids over like 7 or 8 years. They're just old.
Come on, now they're old.
They're older than me.
Yeah, but like, well, how old were you when you saw them all leave, I imagine?
Yes, yes.
I always wonder about that. Was that difficult? Do you remember?
Yeah, it was a little bit. You're leaving me here with these people that are crazy.
Your parents.
Yeah. You know, there's a little bit of, you know, the enthusiasm wanes, right?
Where
they're like,
six?
Oh, you're still here. Yeah, I'm still here. So there was some of that, but there was also, and I, you know, when I started off, I used to, there's such an amount of distrust that develops in parents of that generation, right?
How old were they? How old are they? Are they around anymore?
No.
Neither one of them.
Thanks for bringing it up.
Well, it's talk.
But
I'm sorry.
No, so they, you know, so they were not, they were baby, I don't know what, they were not helicopter parenting. It was kind of, you know, Seinfeld has that joke, it's like, I'll see you at dinner.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So they were that kind of parents.
Right.
But they were but they had been lied to by so many teenagers. By the time I got there, they were just like, you're guilty. And I was like, I didn't do anything wrong. And they're like, just go to your room. And you're like, all right. So
they were jaded.
So the
cynical
paranoia, you know, which I think is pretty important for comedians, this, you know, it's a, you know, you can describe it as paranoia or point of view or suspicion.
Mm-hmm.
I think I learned that from my parents, how they're parenting, how they parented.
You feel like you're paranoid?
I think there's a little bit. You know,
I guess so. Well, it's a type of defensiveness or type of self-protecting. Like, what do you, must be up to something.
Yeah, I remember, you know, when you do, like, I think 100 years ago I did, I was meeting with people that were, you know, writers for a TV show. And they're like, well, you know, we really, you know, we'll capture some of your paranoia. And I'm like, paranoia? But the guy cited this joke I had about Mexican food. He was like, well, that's kind of a paranoid, because I have this thing that there are seven entrees, seven names just for the same type of food.
Right.
And he's like, that's a very paranoid perspective of things. And I'm like, all right, maybe it is.
I don't think that it is. I think it's a simplification.
Maybe.
I think that, you know.
That's kind of paranoid of you to think that.
Is it?
No, I don't know.
But okay, so why so many kids on your parents' part? Were they just Catholic?
They wanted Jews to feel uncomfortable. Well, that's why they did it.
That
was very common. People would have a lot of kids.
Six
people. We lived across from a family that had 13, and the mom would collect all the milk jugs in the garage with all the newspapers. She was crazy.
Well, so that's not common. That's crazy.
Well, no, but large families were pretty common.
13.
I think there's somebody who had...
Somebody. Now it's one person.
Somebody in the Old Testament who had...
No, hundreds. Hundreds.
But 13. Like, my wife's one of nine.
Where'd she grow up?
Milwaukee.
And you grew up where?
In Indiana. But there's also a lot of benefits from a larger family. There's communal clothes.
Yeah.
No, there is something in socialization. I feel like that.
No, I think that's true because you're literally growing up in your own neighborhood.
But what
the neighborhoods in your house?
Let me ask you this.
Sure.
Why is there anything wrong with someone having a large family?
There's nothing. Nothing's wrong with it.
There is
nothing wrong with it. No,
but I've had people secretly say, they're like, I think it's so cool, but aren't you worried about, like, it's like they're
worried
not
about
like,
what?
They're not like dogs that are going to run in the street. They're human beings.
Right. And they listen to you eventually.
So they eventually, you know, some of it's nature and nurture, but some of it is they're going to be how they're going to be. It's like.
Right. Right.
You know, if they're raised with caring parents, that's all that really matters.
No, I don't think I don't have kids. So like, you know, you're asking the wrong guy. But I think that most people just react with sort of like, wow, that seems like a lot of not you. Like, how can you be that selfless? You know, how can you, like, I think most people are fundamentally selfish. And the idea of six kids, it just overwhelms the modern brain. They're like, how do you have time to do anything?
I think we've been culturally told that it's weird. I think that people have been told that, like, by the way, when you think about it, if someone says, I have six cats, you think they're crazy.
Yeah.
But what if someone really enjoys six cats and their apartment isn't covered with cat turds?
That's a long shot. I mean, that's a rare thing you're talking about.
All right,
I don't
maybe
know
that's not good reason.
Well, I mean,
what if
they
have six cats with one leg missing on each of the cats?
Right. Well, no. What I'm saying is that with six kids, you're going to have shit all over the house. There's not going to be any stopping it.
My wife is, pretty thorough. Like, our house is really clean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's not toys all over the place?
No.
Would there be?
Look, I'm a slob.
Yeah. So she's got to clean up after you too?
My apartment, like if you saw my apartment when I was single.
Yeah.
Like people, like my brothers and sisters would come over to my apartment.
You
like,
still live in an apartment in New York?
Yeah.
Well, it's big now. You must have a big like now, six bedroom.
We moved.
Yeah.
But my siblings used to want to come to my apartment so that they could laugh at it.
Uh-huh.
They'd be like, you got to see Jimmy's apartment. Because I had the tub in the kitchen.
Oh, that,
you know, it was a tenement style, right?
Yeah.
They're like, there's a window for no reason in the middle of the apartment. And I'm like, well, there used to be different families living here. But, you know, to someone that lives in the suburbs, it's just insanity.
Well, did you grow up in a rural environment?
It wasn't rural, but, you know, in high school, I definitely went to a couple of parties where I sat on a haystack.
Yeah.
or I a couple of parties where I was in a trailer park drinking a beer.
Sure.
But then again, I was also, well, you know, I mean, there were, you know, Chicago was 45 minutes away.
Right.
And so there was, you know, it was pretty nice existence.
But, no, yeah, I mean, I grew up in New Mexico. We've taken drives out to weird places to sit and drink on rocks.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean.
I could romanticize it and make it sound like, you know, and then I was eating, one summer I ate only hay, you know. But it really was.
Wouldn't that be romanticized?
It was essentially a suburban existence.
Right. And what'd your dad do?
My dad was a banker.
He was a banker.
A banker.
And at a local bank? Did he have his own bank?
A commercial
bank.
It was a local bank in Northwest Indiana.
And your mom was watching children?
Was watching children and
side projects?
Meals on Wheels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Stuff like that, needle pointing awards.
So, I mean, that's the other thing about six kids is that it's like if your dad seemed like he made a nice middle class living, so there was never that panic.
Right. No, there's something about, I make a decent living, so it's as long as I can afford a decent cheeseburger, I'm all right. It's not like I need a boat.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's how I always describe it. I'm like, whoa, you don't know, I can't get my boat. You know, that's not.
You mean the sacrifices you would have to, have to make for having kids?
It's
minimal.
Like, it's like, so I'm going to be balder a year earlier.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh.
Well, what you're saying is that you'll do, you know, whatever's necessary for the kids and you love the kids.
And what I get from these kids is immeasurable. And I know it sounds like a rationalization.
No, not rationalization.
It's amazing.
What is this voice in your head that has decided that people are against big families and that somehow saying that
because,
you get a lot out of your kids?
Because they are. They're all against big families. They're all out to get me.
You are paranoid. Yeah.
Yeah.
I get it.
It goes right back to the beginning.
Yeah, but that's a voice in your head. That's not paranoia. That's a self-judgment thing.
Oh, really? I'm getting reprimanded for being paranoid by Mark Maron.
Yes, you are. Because I've learned things about it. What it is there's part of your brain that go, and I think you vocalize that in your act.
Yeah.
That's sort of that weird id voice you do is that one that's sort of checking you all the time. There's a part of you that's sort of like, I don't know, should I? You know, maybe no one.
We want to have self awareness, right?
Right. Yeah, but self awareness is, and I think that is part of it. But that voice is not always the not always smart.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? That voice is sort of some manifestation of fear.
Right.
Right? So when you were young, you were brought up, how Catholic was it?
I was mostly cultural Catholic. It was kind of like, hey, you're...
Right, right.
You know, we go to church.
Did you go every Sunday? Oh, intermittently.
You know,
I think Jews and Catholics have it better like that. Like, you know, like... So, like regular Christians or people that come to Christianity later, like these really old religions like Catholicism and Judaism, there was sort of the lapse thing was okay. You could be socially Catholic.
Well, they you know, that's when, you know, all this stuff happened with, the radical Islam.
Yeah.
You know, people did describe it that it's the newer of the three.
Right, right. It's like, you know,
It's like, look, we got to give them a couple hundred years and then they'll be drinking with the rest of us.
That might be ordering extra cheesecake. That might be a long destructive wait. So, okay, but your older brothers, what did they end up doing? What was your influences when you were younger? I mean, did you look up to those guys?
Yeah, I was, you know, I think... my older brother Mike kind of rebelled. My father was the first in his family to, after many generations being in this country, to go to college. So success was wearing a coat and tie. And so my brother Mike kind of rebelled against that. And he was like, I'm getting a pickup truck and I'm not wearing that.
Yeah.
And then, but all my sisters and my brothers, you know, very much coat and tie kind of jobs. So
really?
When I announced that I wanted to be in the entertainment industry or be a comedian, they just thought it was cute.
Right. No, he'll get over that.
Isn't that adorable?
Yeah, he'll get past it.
Because, you know, back when I started, it was not, you know, it was not as, adorable or GQ article as it is today.
No, right? I remember when you started. I remember you. You had more hair. It seemed whiter even.
Yeah, it's actually getting, it's...
Maybe the gray is better.
The gray or, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I feel judged.
But,
I feel good.
Yeah, no, you are judged. Yes. I'm not judging you. All right. And I judged you in a positive
way. Do you have your hand on my thigh while
yes,
we do this?
I'm trying to comfort you.
All right.
But you didn't, it wasn't always comedy. I mean, it seemed like, you know, when you were younger that there was another agenda. I remember we talked a bit a long time ago, but I think you might have been the enemy at some point, right?
The enemy?
Yeah.
Like, working in advertising?
No, I mean, before that, jockey, fratty.
Jockey, fratty?
Yeah.
You think the enemy? Jesus Christ. This is such bullshit. The enemy. The enemy. Can I just point something out? It's like, you exist in these, like, mythological kind of constraints that that don't exist.
Uh-huh.
You're like, we're doing a show in Irvine. You're like, you know what? Out there, it's all these people. I'm like, Mark, it's not like, they're not voting for gay marriage right now. These are the people that can afford a $90 ticket to see Louis C.K.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's like, it's yeah. not...
Well, I wanted to make it more complicated than that. Because right. I wanted to, yeah.
Oh, so, but was I what? A frat guy?
Mm-hmm.
I was in a fraternity for a year, but mm-hmm. I never did the final pledge. But that was my freshman year in college. But I don't think that I was...
In high school, who were you? No, I don't get the feeling that you were a bully in any way. But
no,
you were,
no.
No, you...
I was definitely... I mean, look, I'm a comedian because I was kind of tortured because I was so pale and
really
odd when I moved. Yeah. When
People thought you were an albino?
Yeah, there was some of that. And, you know, like... So I was definitely the outcast.
Why are you so fair?
Because I'm cool. That's how God made me.
No, I know that. I'm not judging
you.
No,
why am I so pale?
Do you have Scandinavian in you? Or you?
No, I think it's Irish. It's
pale Irish? I've heard of black Irish. I didn't know there was a white Irish.
Well, you know, all the blonde hair in Ireland, mm-hmm. blonde and red hair, it's just the Vikings coming down. And
so you got Viking. Yeah, I can see you having some Viking in you.
You know, it's... That shows you, I think that's interesting, you know, historically, it's just like the Vikings are adorable.
Yeah.
They're like, you know, the Vikings, you know, that's kind of interesting. They had horns in their
things. They
but they were raping and pillaging.
Yeah, menacing. I always thought of them as the Vikings were like menacing.
You know, we don't look at people in Sweden and go, hey, we got to watch them. They used to be Vikings.
Right.
But, you know, the other countries were kind of like, we got to keep an eye on these.
Well, maybe it's a little before and it didn't get as much press and it kind of got mythologized and romanticized. The Vikings did, you know, a lot of boats and the big
boats,
you know,
wooden boats.
Yeah. And horns.
Horns.
Yeah. All right. So, but were you the funny guy or you weren't the funny guy?
I was the funny guy. I would say I was funniest. But I went to a rare high school. I went to a high school where there were 25 people in my graduating class.
Really?
Yeah.
The private school?
Private school.
I went to one of those briefly. They threw me out. There was only like 35 graduating seniors. It's a little weird, right? And you were on
it's very weird.
And you played team sports. How many people were on the team? Did you?
There was, there was.
Everyone who tried out got on?
Everyone that tried out got on.
Right.
But we were good. Yeah. We were good at things. You know, I beat in wrestling the guy that was third in state, and I played football at Georgetown, but I wasn't a great athlete. But I would say that.
Wrestling.
My high school was very much, it didn't fit the John Hughes stereotypes of, you know, those different kind of characters.
Yeah.
It was more like everyone was everything.
Right. Oh, right. So you didn't have cliques because it was so small and you all kind of knew each other.
Yeah.
It was hard to have a clique. A clique would be what, two guys?
Yeah. It was just, it was not.
And then by the end of the day, they're like, oh, they showed the record they're listening to everybody. And we're all, it's okay.
Yeah. So it didn't really hold up. I hear my wife talk about the clique thing and it sounds terrifying, but.
Jeannie, right?
Yes.
Your wife, who is, she was involved in the last one.
Yes, she was. You were flirting with her during the last
one. She does it to me.
She does do it, huh? You don't have a reputation for flirting at all, either.
You're going to tell me that your wife isn't kooky?
My wife is very kooky. I wouldn't be with a boring woman.
You're going to tell me that I might not misinterpret that as flirting?
I don't know.
I thought it was very sociable. I didn't think there was. Did you feel menacing? You felt menaced from
me? No. I just look. We all have friends that we're like, all right, I got to keep an eye on this guy. And you're one of them.
Me? I'm the guy.
You're evil. Did you just fart? It smells like shit in here.
No.
Yeah, you did. Is it the cat?
No, there's a... I don't know why it happens, but at certain times of night, it smells like raw sewage back here.
Right. And maybe it's because you're letting gas out
I'm not letting
ass.
Gas out of my ass. I'm telling you. I thought it was my pipe, so we didn't flush the toilet or nothing. There's something that happens, and I asked the guy, and he said that all... If you live up on a hill... He said that whoever's in the canyon below there, that there's vents that go up through a house from the the sewage. And that, but I've never smelled
it. Good God. It's like, did a fat bastard take a turd or what?
I've never smelled it this bad. I'm sorry. Yeah. I don't know what's going on. Nice. This is why I don't do interviews at this time of night. I'm evil. How am I evil?
You're not evil. You're just bad. No.
But yeah, look, I think that you know, you've struggled.
I've definitely struggled.
I'm not. I don't think you're any goddamn saint.
I'm most certainly not.
Maybe not. You're maybe not bad in the same way I am.
We all have our demons.
Yeah.
We all have our demons.
I know that. All right. So you're wrestling. You're playing football. There are no cliques in your high school.
Yes.
And you're at a private school. You get good grades.
But I didn't get in any college. So I went to Purdue. And, you know, this is such a suburban struggle. It was like, I didn't get in the college I wanted.
Mark. Yeah, yeah. Were your parents disappointed? What about your brothers and sisters?
My parents went to Georgetown University. They had a dog named Hoya, mm-hmm. and I didn't get in. My brother, my Irish twin, who was like 20 months older than me, was in Georgetown, and I didn't get in.
Why didn't you get in? Why wouldn't they let you in?
I don't know. I think I'm dumb. Yeah, but I transferred in.
After a year at Purdue?
Yeah.
Now, Georgetown's that's a good school.
It is a good school.
Where is that, in D.C.?
Yeah, it's a much better school now than it was then.
And you went all the way through?
Yeah.
Finished it up?
Graduated.
You played football at Georgetown?
For a year.
Yeah.
And then I quit.
Was it too much?
You know, it's just depressing when you'd see people going to parties and you'd be like going to practice.
Yeah. Oh, so it was a practical thing. Social. Yeah. Cut into your social life.
Yeah.
You could be drinking.
I would have nightmares. I'm like, I gotta go to practice tomorrow. And I woke up and I quit. And I remember the guy who, you know, I had to tell these coaches. And this one coach was like, you're going to quit everything. You're going to quit your life. You're going to quit your wife. And I'm like, I don't care. I'm still quitting. He was eating like a big sandwich at the time. He was like a monster. But, you know.
He was trying to intimidate you into staying.
Yeah, but I think that was one of those moments, you know. Did you immediately know you wanted to do comedy? And you're like, all right, I'm going to. Because it was much more of an insane pursuit.
Something about it, for me, it was weird because, you know, I did a little in college. And, you know, after my sophomore year, I did open mics. And I was trying to do it. Yeah. And I just couldn't hack it. I had done a little bit with another guy. Team thing, and I always had the bug. But
that man was Bruce Valanche, right?
Yes, it was. No, Steve Brill, and but I couldn't hack it on my own at first. Like I was drinking a lot that summer, and I was waiting around doing open mics, and it was brutal because they only had them at the clubs.
This was in New Mexico,
in Boston, because I went to BU, and then I kind of put it on hold until I graduated. But right when I got out of college. You know, I went home for 3 months and I went and got a job at the Comedy Store. I mean, I didn't think of it as unreasonable. I was never taught any sort of sense of value or values growing up. I was not moving towards a job.
Right.
I didn't think in terms of a job. I always thought in terms of creative pursuits. When I was in college, I did photography. I wrote plays. I wrote for the paper. I never ever thought about anything practical.
Right.
Which is not the way I was brought up. Were you brought up that way?
I was brought up very much... to seek security.
Right.
That security was a coat and tie.
Would have loved to have had more of that.
I was a wild
insecure animal that was released with no sense of responsibility.
But isn't your dad a doctor or something like that?
Yeah. And which means what? Never home, was not that engaged in the upbringing, occasionally came around to sort of establish power and threaten and make me feel weird.
But that's all dads of that era. My dad would come home and I'd be like, who is that guy?
Yeah.
And you're like, hi. Like, that's some of my acting. Initial acting was acting excited to see this stranger.
Well, I liked my dad. He was a charismatic guy and a little nutty. But But I just, I like when I look back on it, but you said your mother must have been some stabilizing, loving force.
Yes, very much so. And yeah. I think that she, and humor was a very important thing. Making her laugh was an important thing among the siblings. And
why? Because she was like, you knew that you were wearing her out?
Well, I think it was just, it was a difficult task. So humor was something you give someone that it was... You know, it didn't cost anything. And so, also, doing an impression of my dad for my siblings was an important element.
It served a
where
purpose.
They're like, all right, maybe we won't beat him or take his food. I was, at that time, I was not a competitor for food.
Yeah, right, right.
You know?
Yeah, you're the funny guy. You've took some steam, released some steam.
Yes.
All right, so, but you go to school and you go for what?
I studied finance.
But did you really study it, or were you just kind of biding your time?
I was biding my time, but I was, all my siblings who had gone before me studied, like, international terrorism. Before there was terrorism, by the way. This was, like, Bass Separatists that my brother Mike studied. And, you know, they graduated, and they couldn't find jobs. So my dad was very much with me and my older brother, who's right above me. He was like, you guys should study finance or accounting. And, strongly encouraged it. And, you know, I was told that if you do that, then you'll be happy and you'll get a good job and then you'll enjoy that job and then you'll play golf for 5 years and you'll die. And so it's...
That was how you laid it out?
I did that. I remember the night before I graduated from college, I was saying to a friend of mine, I was like, gosh, you know, because we all had jobs and I was like, gosh, you know, all I really want to do is be a comedian.
Yeah.
But I'm like, I'm sure everyone wants to do that. And she was like, no, not everyone wants to do that. I'm like, everyone wants to do that. And she looked at me like, nobody wants to do that.
Right.
And so...
What inspired you to do that, though? What made, and you were, when was this? After, while you were in college?
This is when the night before I graduated.
But how did you get your mind into comedy? Who had you
seen? Because I had worked as a doorman at a place called the Comedy Stop in Washington, D.C. And
so you just, that was just a job you sought out to, or was it?
It was right near my
and they were looking for somebody, or you went to look for it?
All me and my roommates all were doormen there, where we would seat people. And
because you loved comedy, or just because that was
a
gig?
No, it was just a gig.
Okay.
And, but I had also hosted a talent show, which was called Cabaret, with a friend of mine my senior year, which was a talent show, but it was a big deal where everyone would dress in tuxes.
Uh-huh.
And I hosted that, and that was very rewarding, even though I did it. When I did it, I was just completely drunk the entire time.
Did you do bits?
Yeah, I did bits. Kind of school-specific.
Oh, but so you had not done any stand-up yet?
No.
But this was a, like, right, you were the funny guy, and you...
I was the guy that people would, like, there was a guy who actually ended up being an agent at ICM, and he used to get me stoned just so that I would be funny for him. He'd be like, let's get Gaffigan stoned. And so then he would get me high, and they would, and then I would just kind of start rambling.
It's like getting a dog or a cat high.
It was just like, it's like when you give a, let's give a dog some hot salsa, see how it reacts. Have you ever done that?
No.
it's pretty amazing.
What does he do?
Oh, it's, you know, because a dog, you know.
They freak out.
They freak out, but they can't figure out what it is.
Right, that's...
They're like, you don't torture the dog, but it's just like... This is very strange.
Yeah,
they start hitting their nose. Like, wait a minute.
So you torture the dog.
And then they go back and they eat more.
Yeah. So you're working the door at that place, and you're seeing who? Like, is that where you start to get the bug, kind of?
I don't think that gave me the bug. I think that demystified it a little bit for me.
Right. Like, you saw it as a job that could be done.
Yes.
Right.
Where I saw Pat Paulson...
Yeah, running for president?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Again?
Yes. So, you know, different comedians. I think it was maybe a six-month job.
Did no one make an impact on you? Really?
I mean, I have a horrible memory.
Yeah, but you would know, like, if you're like, that guy's good.
Yeah, there were people that were good.
Yeah. You probably work with them now.
Yeah, I'm sure that, you know, Bobby Collins probably went through there, or
Bobby Collins,
you know, or Richard Jenny. I don't know. There was, But it was...
It's interesting, though. You don't have specific memories of a comic.
I don't. I just have a general memory of, like, you know, I could do this.
Yeah.
But, of course, I didn't do it.
Well, no, but you were still in school.
Yeah.
But, well, obviously, did you find them entertaining, or were you just sitting there going,
some,
like,
of them. A lot of them, no.
Right. So you're like, I can't believe this guy.
A lot of them, no. You know?
No, I know. Like, believe me, I know. How am I not going to know that?
You know.
Why are they laughing?
Yeah, why are they laughing? Or, and some of it was just, I just saw confidence on the stage.
Right.
And I was pretty impressed by their confidence.
Right. So you graduate.
Yeah.
And you want to do comedy at that point, but what do you end up doing?
I'm a consultant, and I go to Tampa, and then I...
How long were you in Tampa?
For a year.
Oh, my
God.
And
I'm a pale guy who doesn't like the outdoors, and I remember I went there, and one of the first... I used to always tell people this. I was at a bar, and I was talking to somebody about politics, and some guy said... I said, well, why aren't you going to vote for Dukakis? This shows you how old I am.
Yeah.
And the guy goes, because he's going to let everyone out of jail. And he said it without any irony. And I was like, you know that's not true. And he was like, well. And I was like, oh, all right. So, you know, but there's nothing wrong with Tampa. It's just not right for me. You know what I mean? And so then.
Yeah, it's kind of the Wild West down there, man.
You know, it's an interesting place.
Yeah.
And so then I went to New York and got an advertising job. But I remember having, like, I wrote a Miami Vice episode when I was in Tampa because I wanted to get into entertainment. And I remember having a little micro cassette recorder where I would record ideas. But I remember saying, if I don't find out what I'm going to do, I'm ending this, because I had done everything that, you know, culturally I was supposed to do, or not culturally, but...
So your dad wanted you to do.
I had studied hard. Yeah. I had gone to college. I had studied the security thing. I had gotten the job that was decent money, and I was miserable, and I sucked at it. So at that point, I was like, you know, I just don't know what I'm going to do. And so when I got to New York, I worked in advertising and did an improv class because of fear of stage fright.
Where?
At the National Improvisational Theater. Which was
pre-UCB.
Way pre-UCB.
Yeah, yeah. I don't even know I don't even remember
and
that place.
These guys, this was all run by Scientologists.
Did you know that going in?
I they were very nice about it. They didn't really push it.
Why were they running an improv class?
I don't know. I don't know. And
looking for vulnerable people?
No, I think they were just artists that ended up. You know, it's like there's tons of actors in Scientology.
I get it, but there's got to be a... Okay.
And so...
How'd you find that out?
Because my mother died while I was doing improv, and they're like, you should take a class. And I was like, all right, so I took a class.
For grief?
I think it was... Look, when you lose someone, you're just... Look, you know, you don't know where you're going.
And that's when they said it?
Well, I don't want to present it as malicious. That's what made them happy.
No, it's not malicious. I'm not saying it's malicious. You don't have to be diplomatic. I'm just saying that they saw you were vulnerable, you were upset, you were hurt,
and
they were like, maybe you should take a class.
Maybe this would help you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then when I was doing improv, this guy that was doing the improv classes with me dared me to do stand-up, and that's what I needed. I needed someone to say, come on, let's do this.
Yeah.
And so I did this... stand-up workshop thing and did it that night. And
you remember where that was?
That was at 55 Grove. But I think at that time it was called The Duplex.
Oh, yeah. They had shows there.
Yeah. And they had a picture of Woody Allen up there and Joan Rivers. I think it was
kind of a gay club, right? Later on it became sort of a burlesque sort of...
It was like a piano bar.
Right, right, right.
It was definitely a piano bar. But it was...
I think they had an upstairs, right?
Yeah, it was upstairs.
Right.
It was the showroom.
Right. I've done a show there.
So I remember it was the first time I did it, and it was amazing.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
You were like, thank God I'm here.
I was like, I finally found out what I want to do.
Yeah.
And then I bombed for the next 4 years.
But, no.
You know, not completely, but, you know, I definitely... I feel like it takes me longer to figure things out, but Yeah, there was no spots to be had in the city. So
I remember when, what year was that? Because I remember when you started, and I remember when I started to see you. You were kind of like, I remember you sort of tucked your shirt in a lot.
Yeah.
And you were kind of heavy, and your hair was bushier.
Yeah.
And you were a little sweaty, and you always seemed kind of miserable.
Yeah, no, I was very miserable.
Yeah.
Very miserable. Well, you know, I always describe it because, you know, I started with Geraldo.
Yeah.
And Geraldo and I met.
He was also chubby and sweaty.
And we were both wearing suits.
Yeah.
He was a lawyer, and I was an advertising guy. I switched to copywriting, but... Uh-huh.
That's a little creative, isn't it?
It was. It was a little creative. I mean, a little.
Yeah.
But...
Did you ever nail any campaigns?
Yeah, I mean, I worked on some campaigns, but it's... There's something about stand-up comedy where we're spoiled by the lack of hierarchy and bureaucracy.
Right. Right.
Where, you know, in advertising, there's a lot of it. There were so many good comedians. Like, when I started, here's how I...
What year was it again? 89, maybe 91? 90,
92.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I viewed it, there was... Me and Geraldo and Judah, and then the new group, which was Attell, you, Todd Barry, Louis, Jeff Ross.
Just a couple years ahead.
And then above them,
the old guys.
Was the old guys.
Yeah.
So you guys would be getting spots and slowly chipping away at these spots, but so Geraldo and I started driving out to Long Island, and then sometimes I would go to the Comedy Tree in the treehouse
in Connecticut. Yeah. So you guys, you spent a lot of time with Greg.
Yeah.
How sad was that? It's horrible.
It's amazing.
I couldn't believe it. Fucking believe it.
It's really
so smart and so funny, but couldn't get a handle on that shit.
Well, it's also, you know, I'm sure the people kind of view it as, oh, well, that's he was kind of a rock and roll comedian. But when I met him, he was not like that.
No, he was not.
And
he's like a hardworking, writer, really, wrote really his intelligent ass off. Guy. Yeah.
And some of it is, I don't know, but it's what people don't realize is it's the repeated amount of rejection. Like, you think you reach a threshold where you're like, I did Letterman.
Yeah.
Now everything's okay.
Yeah.
But there's something about stand-up where you get, the entertainment industry in general, you get either too much praise.
Too soon.
Or none.
Right.
So you're either kind of a real repeated abusive situation. It's like, come here, smack. Come here, smack. And so I witnessed Greg... You know, Comedy Central deal after Comedy Central deal after Comedy Central deal. And he was somebody who had an enormous amount of success in his life. He had great interpersonal skills. He got me on. We would go to Long Island, and these Long Island guys would be like, we're not putting on the doughy white guy.
Yeah.
And Greg would be like, he's a friend of mine. You know, because Greg was from Queens. He could deal with these guys. Yeah. And, so he had all the skills. You know, he went to Harvard Law. He had every situation he could talk. But there is, and stand-up is a bit of a meritocracy, but the entertainment industry is not.
Right.
So, you know, it's why, you know, you remember me as miserable.
Yeah.
It's like, I can't believe I can't pass at the comic strip.
Right.
And so Greg was fine with that stuff. He could work that. But the rejection of... things that used to work, I mean, things that should work, but just the bureaucracy of television, I think it really took a toll on him.
Yeah, yeah. Something's going to take a toll on you.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he tried to get a handle on it, and it's a sickness, you know? It's hard, you know? But, like, when you were wandering around, though, were you depressed?
Oh, yeah. I think so.
Yeah.
I think there's something about... a low grade. I mean, my depression kind of displays itself in anger.
Yeah.
Does it sound familiar?
Sure.
And
were you a rager, though?
I think it's like I was raised Irish Catholic, so it was a temper.
Yeah.
But it's just, the anger didn't match the crime. That's where it was.
Yeah.
That's where I could see it and go, oh, all right. And so there's some chemical stuff there, but I think there's also something, we're all crazy, uh-huh. like comedians, uh-huh. and we're control freaks, and there's elements that we can control in stand-up, and there's elements we can't control. And
I never thought of myself as a control freak, but I guess, like, you know, when you're on stage, that's your thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, we got the microphone,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And we have our bag of tricks.
Yeah.
And so there is something about, you know, but, we're, you know, it's not set up where, you know, gaining the approval of a comedy club or a theater,
yeah.
and then getting all that praise and then shutting it down and then going to our bedroom.
Right.
Or our hotel room.
Yeah.
It's like, I mean, I'd like to see, you know, even the most well-adjusted Tom Hanks version
right. yeah.
of a human being be able to pull that
off. Oh, yeah, to do Irvine, to do like, we did like, what, 15,000, 16,000 people. Yeah. I got on my Toyota.
Right.
And I drove back here and I had some cereal.
Right.
It's bizarre.
Right. So it's, and I think for me, it's like one of the things I've learned is that I think I'm above, you know, I intellectually can go, well, you know, I've figured this stuff out, but you have to repeatedly learn it.
Yeah.
You have to sit there and go, you know what? You are jealous. You are jealous of this situation. You know what? You are in a vulnerable situation. You know, like the oddball thing, it's fun, but it's also, I'm spoiled because I go and I do these theater shows with my hand-picked opener.
Yeah.
So I don't have to worry
right.
about what I'm going to follow.
Right.
I know what I'm going to follow.
Yeah.
And I think there's something great about that, but there's also something where you can get lazy.
Yeah.
So it was kind of fun. It was fun following Sarah, and it was fun following Bill Burr, but it's also, you know, like, you know, like when that night that I followed Bill Burr, I'm like, wait a minute, he's, you know, he's like, you know, it's like, you know, this anger, like, fuck that shit,
yeah.
And then I'm going up there and going, wah, wah, wah. You know what I mean? So I'm like, musically, this doesn't fit.
Yeah, but you're Jim Gaffigan.
I know, but some of it is.
You don't think that?
I think there's, you know, I look back.
I was completely impressed with you. I mean, I got on Mike's show and I talked about it.
I know. I heard it. Thank
yeah.
You very
and
much.
I mean, I was like, you know, like I, you know, I know Bill, I know Sarah, I know everybody, but I don't get to see you work that much. I
yeah.
see them around a bit.
Yeah.
So like seeing you like come down off the mountain.
Oh, yeah.
And just kind of lay it out with your music and your sort of rhythm. I was like completely impressed. And I was talking to you backstage. You're like, I don't know. And I'm like, what don't you know? You
yeah.
do this every night in front of thousands of people.
Yeah.
But I know, but I mean, we're all like that.
Yeah. Yeah, we're all like that. Or, you know
but
what?
There wasn't
actually,
even...
you and I are like that. I feel like I look at other people and they're like, yeah, who cares?
Yeah.
And I'm like, what? You don't care?
Yeah.
But I think it's important to care.
Yeah, of
it's
course.
Important.
I think they're pretending, man.
Really? Okay.
They're just around us. Yeah, I think they got to be, you know, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, like, there's not room for more than two of us walking around going like, oh, man, huh? What's going to happen out there?
Is that lighting right? Yeah.
Are they going to be able to hear with the mic?
But there is, the lessons of comedy, it's so great because, you know, having young kids and seeing just the battlefield of childhood, I mean, it's insane. And my kids are very nice, and they have friends and everything.
What are
but
the
it's
ages?
Terrifying. 10, 8, 5, 3, 2. So just, you know, dropping my kids off at soccer camp, my older ones, and I brought my 3-year-old. And I turn around, and some kid's bullying. Some 8-year-old is bullying a 3-year-old. And I had to hold myself back from punching this kid. I was like, do not ever think. You know, like, it's like, you might, and I do this, my wife thinks I'm crazy. Like, if anyone's ever rude to my kid, I go right up to them and I go, what are you doing? What are you doing? And she's like, Jim, you look crazy. I'm like, I don't care. Maybe my kid will see, like, my dad is crazy.
Yeah.
But he's got my back.
Right.
You know, so it's.
How do kids respond to that?
I grabbed this kid and I tried not to squeeze his, I grabbed him.
What was he doing?
My 3-year-old was wearing a baseball cap. Yeah. And 3-year-olds, they're like orangutans, yeah, right? They don't know what they're doing.
Yeah.
And so he flipped it off, and he was kind of like pointing it at my son. So I grabbed him by the arm, and I was like, you're coming with me. So I went to find a camp counselor. It's a soccer camp.
Yeah.
And the soccer camp, the guy, it's just like this summer Manhattan soccer camp.
Right.
It's nothing fancy.
Yeah.
This guy's like, you know, this beats working being a janitor.
Right.
I said, this guy was bullying my 3-year-old son. And he looked at me like, I don't care. I really don't care. And I was like, all right, well, at least I did the right thing. Yeah, you know.
It would have been hilarious if he just bullied you. So what's the problem?
Yeah, so what's the problem, pussy?
When did you meet Jeannie?
I met her in, I guess, 99, 2000.
Uh-huh.
I don't think I had confidence in, you know, till I was in my 30s.
Yeah. You know, real confidence. You mean.
Real confidence, right. Where
we got fake it for a while.
It's where, you know, this is a beautiful woman. I'm going to talk to her. She might want to talk to me.
Yeah.
Before that, I was just like, glug, 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 you know.
Yeah.
So, but I think by then I had some confidence and I had dated some attractive women. So I was not intimidated that she was beautiful or a strong woman or anything like that. So, yeah.
And she turned out to be the best thing for you in the world.
I think so. I mean, it's pretty amazing. I mean, you know, I talk about her being my writing partner.
But that took a while.
That took a while. And it's very counterintuitive, right? Like, you've had many girlfriends.
Yeah.
How often do you sit there, you know, I'm going to write with her. It's never the
equation.
But
you guys were kind of writing together before you really were public about it.
I would say there was some, she definitely was kind of coaching me in my acting. And
well, did she come from that?
Yeah. She has like a master's degree in theater and all that.
Uh-huh.
And and she'd done sketch comedy and she'd done some stand-up.
Right.
And so she knew the comedy world. But, you know, comedian to a comedian giving you a tag, you're always kind of like polite, thanks.
Yeah,
even though you thought of it, right?
Right.
And so I assume that would be the relationship with her. And, but it became very much... you know, there was great insights. And then there was her, you know, we would have debates on where a joke would go or the value of doing it this way versus that way. And so eventually it came to a point where I was like, yeah, you know, she's definitely my writing partner. I mean, I definitely have the final say.
Right.
It's not like I'm, you know, I'm doing this 10 minutes because my wife made me do it. You know, it's not that, but it's, there's also something about in this business, it's, I don't care about the credit. I care about the product. You know what I mean? So, you know, if, you know, occasionally on Twitter, people will be like, did your wife write that joke?
Yeah.
I'm like, I don't give a shit. Yeah. You know, it's like, if you really think that, that's fine. But it's a pretty pretty good collaboration.
Hopefully well, it seems like it. Up. Yeah. I don't think you'll mess it up. You're too far in.
In far too deep.
That's right. But when did, now, what's interesting to me is, though, you know, you come from this background where, there was a premium put on security,
yes,
on working, and your work ethic. And you know, more than most comics, you seem to have over time fairly, seemingly deliberately figured out a way to really, you know, find your audience. And it's a big audience. And you've never been sort of, you know, ashamed or thought about, like that doing commercials was a bad thing or that doing right. any of that stuff. I mean, it seems like your work ethic is one that seeks security, that, you know, that you were confident enough in who you were and your style and what was funny about you that you weren't like, yeah, I'm not doing that.
Yeah. I mean, I mean, I definitely kept my day job longer, but some of it was for creative reasons. Like, I kept my day job so that I wouldn't have to go and do a bar show in New Jersey, or I wouldn't have to take, because Geraldo quit his job pretty early. And so I would see him go and do these wrestling match shows,
right.
You know, and, I think that there was some unconscious, search of security, but no one going into stand-up. I definitely got to a point where I was like, all right, because, you know, I never imagined I would be married. I was like, I came to a conclusion. All right, I'm going to be the weird uncle.
Yeah.
That lives in a small, filthy apartment that in Manhattan.
That your brother and sister bring the nieces and nephews over to see the bathtub in the kitchen.
Right. Yeah. And that, and I had gone through and been rejected by all these festivals for, you know, I'd been doing stand-up. Everyone, all you guys and Geraldo and Ian Bagg had all done Conan and all these late night shows. And I had been rejected by all of them. So I had gone through all this anger. And I had gotten to a point where, all right, I'm doing this because I love doing it. Maybe I'm going to be able to make a living combining the commercials and stand-up. But I don't, like, Geraldo wanted to headline. I didn't really see, like, wanting to headline. That wasn't my goal. I know it sounds like, you know, the actor that's like, I just wanted to do community theater. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah. What did you want to do?
I wanted to be a writer on Letterman. I wanted to be a writer on Letterman, or, you know, my goal really was to do stand-up on Letterman. That was, if I could do stand-up on Letterman, then all these years,
you would be vindicated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And because, you know, back then it was, if someone found out you're a comedian, they'd say, have you been on any shows?
Right. You need the validation.
Yeah.
So you were actually doing some acting work before, you know, you really broke as a comic.
Yeah, there was plenty of times when people thought that I did a movie with Dennis Leary and he didn't know I was a comedian.
So that hurts.
It's, you know, in some ways I didn't care.
In some ways, yeah.
No, but it wasn't, you know, I mean, that was 20 years ago.
No, I know, but I'm just trying to see, like, because what I was saying is basically that once you did realize your stand-up, and once you built a business around your stand-up, and that's, you know, including, you know, television projects and doing like Three Kings and showing up in movies and commercials, that I think because of your wife and your family, that your, you know, your values were very specific. You know, I've got a family to feed.
Right.
And I think that, you know, when I see your output and how, you know, diligently you are with releasing CDs, DVDs, and now the book market seems to be good for you, and then kind of pushing forward and becoming, like, you know, a theater act almost exclusively, I have to assume that some of that is, you know, thankfully, you know, driven by your family responsibilities.
I think, yeah, I think fear as a motivator is pretty important.
And you're very, you know, you're very.
But I like working. I like.
No, I know, writing, but I mean, yeah, but like, and the thing is that, you know, usually you'd be saying this stuff about, you know, somebody who would do anything, but you don't. You're very specific. And, you know, do you remember when you started to break or how it happened?
Gosh, because there's important moments where, you know, getting on Dr. Katz was like huge.
Sure. I remember that. Yeah, those were all great. But that was sort of like, I want to be one of the guys moments.
Well, it was. Yeah, that was I want to be one of the
right.
guys. But it was beyond the pale. It was Comedy Central. I had done a half hour. Geraldo and I did it the same night. And then Geraldo had done two more half hours. And I couldn't get arrested at Comedy Central. And then my manager was with same management company that handled the blue collar guys.
Right.
And Comedy Central was like, you want any more hours? And my manager was like, what about Jim Gaffigan? And so it was like a different person. So like this hierarchy at Comedy Central, someone else had bought an hour from me. So the Beyond the Pale got on Comedy Central and that changed everything.
It did.
That completely changed everything. So the Hot Pockets joke was on there. When I had done my half hour, they didn't use Hot Pockets.
Thank God.
In my and Beyond the Pale, they didn't have tons of hours of stand-up, and they could air it at any time. So it just, they aired the hell out of it, and it just served as an infomercial. And so that turned me into a theater. It took like 6 months after it started airing.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, it was all Beyond the Pale that really did it. And then, you know, I think combined with a lot of acting roles, so people were like, oh, he was from, you know, had that part in Sex and the City or had that part in...
Right. And they had all sort of, you became a guy that was across all their mediums.
It was just we could sell 800 tickets in the theater.
Right. So, but what's also significant is that, you know, you're dealing, I think, what was probably Comedy Central's issue was that your comedy was it sort of timeless, but it's also sort of grown up. And, you know, in a way, I would assume that your audience was primarily adults or people your age-ish.
You know, it's weird because I don't, you know, like, because it's like I'm doing this show for, that's going to be on TV Land and Comedy Central. Yeah. And that's the first instinct. Everyone's like, yeah, you know, 50-year-olds like 40-year-olds like this stand-up. But that's not the case. The case is that 20-year-olds and 40-year-olds like it. And so at my
shows...
And
they can go together.
No,
seriously.
No, but the thing is, Comedy Central, it was TV Land was just going to do it.
Right.
And then it was presented as, well, Comedy Central might be 18 to 25 or whatever the demographics are, but those are the people that are watching my special on Comedy Central.
Right.
So I don't know what I'm trying to say here, but it's...
You're just saying your audience is
it's people not, think it's, you know, it's people like you, Jim, with kids, and no, it's but it, you look at like people that go to comedy shows, they're not people that have kids.
Right. But I guess what I'm saying is that, you know, you are the kind of act that, you know, a dad could bring his kid to. You're right. Also the kind of act that, you know, a son could
bring his dad to.
And also a kid who could bring his girlfriend to and not feel embarrassed.
Right.
And, you know, and I don't want to say family act, but I mean, but, you know, your humor is universal and your craft is solid and it's not, you know, and I don't think you're I don't think you're without risk. You know, I think that your character is clearly has darkness to it and there's struggle there.
Yeah.
But, you know, you're fairly calculating in that, you know, whether you want to be clean or not, you don't find it necessary to not do that. And it's a smart choice.
Well, here's how I kind of describe it is I think that comedians get too much credit and too much criticism for what the type of stand up they do anyway.
Right.
So people must be like, you're so honest, Mark.
Yeah.
But in a lot of ways, that's the only stand-up you would do.
Yeah, it's the only, I can't right? do it any other way.
So it's not to say that I don't curse in everyday life, but if I'm writing a joke and rewriting it,
yeah,
it's not necessary to curse if I'm talking about steak, you know? so the whole thing is that it's, you know, look, I'm not somebody who would... Like, you might go on stage in front of a room full of strangers and say, fuck you all, motherfuckers. But I'm kind of like, there's a little bit of the Midwestern where I'm like, well, I don't want to curse. There's someone's grandma right there. So, and it took me a while to realize that.
But that also has to do with writing. My writing process is all, you know, improvisational. So yeah. I think that when, because you're very meticulous, I mean.
But I'm improvising on stage a lot.
Right.
But there's... You know, it's
but
weird.
You know where your beats are.
I know. Well, there is something about you can't do this for 15, 20 years.
Yeah.
And not start writing on stage.
Of course.
And so there is something about.
I'm just saying that when you know where your beats are, like the idea that, you know, when you're working a joke about steak.
Yeah.
And you've structured your beats, you don't have to say fucking steak.
Yeah.
But if I'm just on stage and I just ate a steak, I'm like, ugh, fucking steak. I'm going to do that.
Well, it's authentic for you, right? It's authentic for Chris Rock. It's authentic for Lewis Black.
Right.
But it's weird because, you know, Brian Regan, it's you know, it's like, you know, we've both said the same thing in interviews. It's like our favorite comedians are filthy.
Yeah.
But it's not like one of those things where Jesus told me to not curse. It's just kind of, and I really do, if it's how the stand-up comes out.
Yeah.
And, you know, David Cross can only do that type of comedy.
Right.
He could do a character of a different type of comedy. And it's, some of it is finding your point of view and your voice.
When did you first start doing the second voice?
The second voice was something that was, it was kind of... It was part of my personality as a teenager where I would talk to somebody and it would just diffuse the situation. It's like, I can't believe Jim's sitting in my garage. I hope Jim doesn't want this to come out when his book's published.
Yeah.
But I'm going to fuck him by not releasing it then. But so some of it is, it's a great tool for diffusing any awkwardness.
Right.
It's an awareness.
Right.
But I didn't do it the first 6 years I did stand-up. I remember I started doing it in D.C. at the D.C. Improv when I was, you know, in the middle before Attell. And Attell would make fun of me. He's like, oh, really? You know, you're going to do this? Okay, Grandpa.
Yeah.
And So it was kind of something where I used to also think I'm just talking so that when I'm on at the cellar at 1 a.m, I don't give them time to say anything.
Right.
It's like, I'll comment.
Yeah.
All right. Don't worry. Right. Just relax. Yeah. I know I'm talking about bacon for too long.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we all have voices in our head.
Yeah.
It's just giving them a platform.
I just recently started doing this blogger I don't know if I did it the night you saw me, where I say I have an inner blogger that's reviewing my show as it's going along.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maren started off strong, but now he seems to have taken, he's sort of sidetracked. He thinks this joke's real smart, but it's not smart at all.
Yeah, exactly. We all have this inner critic. Yeah. And you know, New York comedy, I mean, you look at, like, Johnny Carson used to comment on his jokes.
Yeah.
But when we were in New York at that point, when it was really kind of, I'm not going to say it was hand-to-hand combat, but if you showed vulnerability, it was weakness by the audience. There's a good reason why, you know, Kevin Brennan, Louis C.K., Dave Attell, you know, there is a deadpan in how they deliver things.
Right.
You know, Todd Barry. It's because if you show the happy, sweet kind of like, hi, I'm a lovable, you will get eaten alive.
In New York.
And that's considered weakness.
Right.
And I think it's changed a lot.
Well, no, I think the comedy has opened up a bit. So that was your way of being vulnerable, in a way.
I think so. And weird.
Yeah, but it became completely, you know, a defining part of your voice.
Yeah.
And did you know it when you did it first? Were you like, I got something with this?
No, well, I thought it was a great opportunity to come up with additional tags from a different point of view.
Right.
So I was like, I can get a couple more jokes in here.
Yeah.
I can, you know, there's not going to be a crazy Christian woman in this audience who's judging this, but they will enjoy this point of view.
Right. Right.
So, there was some of...
Yeah, because it's a great...
You know, it would whiff every now and then.
What does that mean?
It means I would do it and people would just be like, this is just stupid.
Right.
So when I did my initial Comedy Central half hour, I chickened out and I didn't do it at all.
Really?
Yeah. So I had been doing it for like a year. And then...
Would you have, like, a bad night when you were running it?
I think, you know, it was probably 50-50, or maybe it was probably 80-20, but I was like, you know what? This is a TV special. I don't want to risk it.
Uh-huh. But Beyond the Pale, you were like, you got to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was the defining moment. But you've been very diligent about, you put out a new album every year?
No, I'd say every 2 years.
And now the book thing, you got coming out now is the second book?
Second book.
That thing feels like it was right on top of the other one.
Yeah. Well, this is a food book, and I feel like I've been writing about food for 20 years anyway. It's kind of, you know, half of the book was compiling it into essays, and half of it was kernels of ideas or tweets that, you know, were topics.
Is that your demon?
Food?
Yeah.
I think that's the one that people see.
Yeah.
You know?
What do you got? What other one?
Oh, I'm going to tell you. No, I've got a lot of demons. I think that,
you don't drink anymore?
No, I drink occasionally. Yeah. I went through 5 or 6 years where I didn't drink at all, where I was like, I really want to get on top of this. But I don't, my demons, I have a fair amount of them.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it's... you know, I think that there's, you know, jealousy is still a strange thing, but...
That's all insecurity stuff.
It's all insecurity, but I think that stand-up comedy is, you know, the opportunity... Like, I don't know if you encounter this. It's pretty common. You know, it's like, I'm kind of grumpy. I do a set. It's you know, the endorphins flow.
Yeah.
Right? There's nothing that...
Right.
And I don't care where it is. It's that's one of the things that I learned. I know that it's cooler to do a show at the Cellar or at a certain place, but I just care about getting up on stage. And I think it's important to be able to make a lot of different types of people laugh, particularly people that look at you like, I don't think I'm going to like you.
Or don't know you.
winning them over yeah. is really fun.
Getting the people that are like, you know, because now I'm in this weird place where, you know, usually if I do a club, I can sell it out, but there's still going to be a good quarter to a third of the people. They're just there for comedy.
Right.
And them going like, yeah, I didn't know you at all. But that, yeah, yeah. Then it's like, that's it.
Yeah.
That's the best. Yeah. Because that's your job.
Yeah.
You just entertained a stranger.
Well, that's the valid. And that's what I realized looking back on, you know, the oddball thing. Maybe Louis made reference to this, but that's why he did it, is because he's at such a level of fame that if he follows Bill Burr, who's crushing, mm-hmm. it is a true serum for his act.
Right.
Now, I don't know if that's, you know, the balancing act is, I think people are funniest when they're most comfortable, but there's also a belief that people, you know, a lot of humor comes out of, you know, situations of fear. Like, I have to do well or I will die a miserable death in front of
right. No,
20,000
people. But that's
people.
Weird because I will beat the shit out of myself
yeah.
in that moment and have to transcend that on top of do well. Like, right. for me, it's like, I don't ever go out there with the warrior spirit, like, I'm going to fucking kill it. Yeah. It's just sort of like, oh, God damn it.
Right. It's not getting in our own way. I mean, I remember one time I asked Seinfeld, I was like, what do you do when you follow someone who's really filthy? And he goes, it doesn't affect me at all. And I'm sitting there going, what? You know, because I believe stand-up is very much a conversation.
Yeah.
And our point of view and our relationship,
yeah.
it's... You know, there's, you know, you can be a tell who's kind of the formula. My jokes are so funny. I don't care if you like me or not.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's this long conversation. And some of it is unselfish. The more comfortable I feel, the funnier I'm going to feel.
Absolutely.
And if I come up with a line during a show, I will love you forever.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean? And it'll be better for them. So... I don't know if I, you know, I appreciate the fact that I grew up doing stand-up in front of audiences that you would just see those dead eyes,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I mean, pre-Obama, just tables of African-Americans turning away from you because you were the wrong color.
Right.
But, and I think it did, you know, there is some calluses that are important for making you an authentic comic. But I think being in front of a warm audience is pretty good.
Well, it's great. And I'm just experiencing it for the first time because you can be truly comfortable. And right. that's where shit happens.
And that's where...
Because you've got 20 years of fucking craft under your belt. And if you don't have to fight, something's going to happen.
And that's where... I mean, I think... You know I've said authenticity, but if you can go up there and be authentically funny where they know you're just making it up...
Yeah.
That's
it.
That's gold.
That's crack.
That's gold. And then you can go into like, you know, all right, let's start hitting some pop flies for you people, you know? So.
All right, man. Well, that's great. So the book, the new one's called?
Food, a Love Story.
And when's the show on?
It's the show's on in June.
All right. That's when we'll put this up.
You're going to wait that long?
No, I'm kidding.
No, I'm going to wait till after your show premieres. Okay. And then I'll go to my therapist and I'll say, you know, I feel kind of guilty.
Come on.
I just, you know, I don't want him to succeed.
No, how am I? You already won. All right, well, thanks for talking to me, James.
All right, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
That's it. That's our show. Jim's the best. It's hilarious. Go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF pod needs. Check those tour dates. I'll be near you somewhere. All right, you can go to the calendar and you can see all the dates and venues, and you can the links will be right there to buy tickets. You can get your justcoffee.coop over there. You can leave comments on the comment board. You can do whatever you need. Shit! God damn it. I want to thank... The band Mae McDonough and Company, they're a great band. I enjoyed their record. But out of nowhere, they sent me this lovely handmade fuzz pedal. It's a Boomer Lives pedal with Boomer on there and a psychedelic design and two knobs, one that says meow and one that says purr. And it's just a fucking, just a kind of a breaking apart fuzz number. What does it sound like? Yeah.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.